Hi, I'm Aisha, and I'm a former host of Mocha Single Mothers by Choice, or SMCs. Like you, as an SMC, I decided to become a mother knowing I'd be the sole care provider and parent of my children, at least at the outset. The Mocha stood for Black, so I'm using the word Black, and I'll be discussing being a single mother by choice from a Black woman's lens. You'll connect with all the interesting and fun things about this non-traditional path, like discussing which sperm to use and some hard truths about fertility and the realities of dating as a single mother who doesn't have a co-parent to rely on occasionally,
and what it's actually like to parent as an SMC.
This is the Black Single Mothers by Choice podcast. In this episode, as an SMC, we know that there are various ways to motherhood. Today, we're going to discuss becoming an SMC via adoption. All right, so today we have two guests. We have Angela and Michelle. Angela is a software sales executive living in the Northeast as an SMC via domestic infant adoption to a five-year-old son who's her joy and is currently considering welcoming a second child. And we also have Michelle, who's an adoption attorney in the Chicago area, and also an SMC by adoption, and will be speaking with us today from the legal side of adoption, drawing from her vast experience. All right, so just a disclaimer that adoption laws can vary state to state, so make sure that you consult an adoption attorney in your state if this is your path. All right, so I'm going to ask Angela and Michelle to introduce themselves. We'll start with Angela.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting us to be guests on the podcast this evening. And as Aisha said, I am a mother to a five-year-old son via adoption, and I'm very passionate about trying to help other folks who are pursuing this path. So I'm glad to be here and to be a resource to others.
All right. And Michelle, hello.
Hi, how are you today? I'm happy to be here, too. I am an adoption attorney. I have been an adoption attorney for about 3 decades now. I also do adoption education, speak at a lot of conferences and camps, and I'm a single mom by choice. My son is 11 years old, and I am a proud boy mom.
Welcome, and thank you both for being here today. Okay, when I was trying for my second child, I had considered almost every aspect of becoming an SMC for a second time. When I was trying for my daughter, I explored adoption through foster care. And when I say I explored, I actually talked to SMCs who had done infant adoption and also who had done adoption through foster care. And I actually sat with my thoughts in that research for a bit. And I did have some questions at the time. And as part of this conversation, I'll talk a little bit about the questions that I had, as both Angela and Michelle will go ahead and share. So could we start from the beginning and just go through the adoption process in general, and then we get into some specifics? Because similar to, I was daunted by the home study and the adoption classes, and just starting that process was overwhelming. So can you take us through, let's see, Michelle or Angela, whichever one of you wants to jump in?
Okay, I'll start with the basics. The first thing is, usually for most people, you got to figure out which route you want to go. And there are basically 3 distinct routes, right? You have domestic infant adoption, which is basically getting a newborn. Or you can go through the foster care route, which is using different states, call it by different names, whatever foster care or child protective services are in your area. Or the third option is international adoption. Now, once you start talking about those 3 areas, then they break down into sub areas. Like with domestic infant adoption, we call it in the social media world, we call it DIA for short. You could have an agency adoption. You can have an adoption through a lawyer. You can have an adoption, what we call agency assistant, where like you found your match somewhere else, whether it's through your pastor, your doctor, or a friend of a friend, you happen to be talking to someone in a bar that you want to adopt, and the person says, oh, I know someone who's pregnant and wants to place. Yes, this is a true story. Single mom by choice, but hopeful adoptive mom had been whining that her husband was in a bar talking about his wife wanting to adopt and that hadn't happened. And he was standing next to a man who said, I know a woman who's pregnant and is thinking about placing for adoption. Sure. And that's how the connection was made, theory. Like when I'm talking to my clients, I'm like, you need to have a big mouth. And a lot of times people are very anxious. They don't want to tell everybody their business. They, whatever the reason is, they want to adopt. They just don't want to tell people. And I'm like, look, you don't know who knows who. Uh-huh. And if you don't say that you want to expand your family by adoption, your sister may know somebody, but you haven't told your sister, or your sister hasn't told your college roommate, or whatever the case is. You have to get the word out there that you're looking, because you don't know where that match may come from. But you may have a match that's not through a traditional agency. You find it some other way, is my point. And then we might bring an agency in to do the social work, which is called agency assistant. It is not as expensive as an agency adoption because they're not making the match. They're only doing agency assistant. Also, some people use consultants. Some people use facilitators. Facilitators, by the way, are illegal in about half the states. So don't sign up with a facilitator. Facilitators basically advertise for the connection of pregnant women to adoptive parents, right?
Okay.
And so there's a middleman, I would say. And frankly, I've always been amazed that agencies never figured out how to do it as well as the middleman have, but they have. And so for adoptive parents, they feel very strongly in using facilitators because the facilitator basically is getting paid to find you an expectant mom. And frankly, they spend a lot of money on IT so that they pop up first and so on and so forth. Where agencies tend to have the philosophy that we're trying to find a family for the baby, not we're trying to find an expectant mom who's having a baby for the family. People often hire facilitators because that is exactly what they're looking for, is the expectant mom who's going to have a baby in the match. And they want to pop up at the top of the internet.
So, Angela, I know we talked a little bit and you were saying that there are various ways that you can go about finding hopeful expected moms. Am I using the terms correctly?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mothers, right? And you said that there are different ways and some of them are non-traditional. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah. And if I could just make a quick point to double down on what you said earlier, Aisha, and reflecting on what Michelle said, which, by the way, Michelle, great overview of the three main paths to adoption. But I did want to underscore specifically because we're talking about facilitators. That's one of the things that is not legal in every state. So it's a perfect example of what you articulated earlier, that you can't assume that you can always use a facilitator. But to answer your question directly, Aisha, about websites, what you're talking about is self-matching, right? So if you don't use a facilitator, if you don't use an agency or an attorney, it's becoming more and more popular for people to say, you know what, let me bypass that part of the process. And by the way, they're usually, particularly for using an agency, is an associated match fee, if you will. So it is a way, which I know we'll probably get to mitigate the cost of the adoption, is to self-match. So it can happen serendipitously, the way that Michelle told that great story about the guy in the bar, but it can be more proactive as well. So there are actually lots of websites that are out there that really it's akin to a dating site, if you will, but it's about matching a prospective or a hopeful adoptive parent with an expectant mother. So just like you would if you were using an agency, you create a website that has a profile. And on that profile, it's going to have pictures of you and your family. You might have a picture of your pets, things that you like to do. You'll be able to write a little biography about why you wanted to adopt, et cetera. And you will pay a monthly fee for this. And usually you have a way that expectant mother can communicate with you, whether it's a separate adoption email. Some people will set up, and I did this, a separate 1-800 number. So there's no fee to the birth mother. And then, or even texting, which a lot of them prefer to do. And that's the route we went as well. And then you can start communicating and decide whether or not it's something that you both are interested in pursuing. So it's an interesting and kind of modern way of meeting a potential match. So this is a big question. I think we probably both want to answer this. So I'm going to answer it briefly, and I'm sure Michelle's going to want to jump in on this one. So adoption scams are real and they happen all the time. There are people who will try to financially scam you But I think the worst ones are emotional scamming, where they pretend to be pregnant. There's even websites out there where you can make a fake sonogram, et cetera. Part of the ways you protect yourself, for example, if you work with an agency, they're going to train you on things to listen for. And that's also part of their job, is to help that prospective expectant mother in terms of being able to show proof of pregnancy. And the other thing that I found very valuable is that there are actually all kinds of websites and also Facebook groups specifically dedicated to ending adoption scams. So hopeful adoptive parents will share information and try to identify folks who are known scammers. But Michelle?
All of that information was great. And I can only add that I think that, one, you should get an adoption professional involved immediately. So you can make that match, but as soon as you make that match, you need to hire either an adoption agency, social workers, adoption lawyers, depending what the scenario is and what the state law is. And what I have discovered is, beyond the fact that some of us adoption lawyers actually are connected in networks and have the ability to talk to each other to try and avoid some of the scammers, the other thing is that most scammers will disappear real quickly if you start asking the questions that professionals start asking. And when the proof of pregnancy, they're able to spot it better than people who've never been pregnant before, for example, right? And so yeah, they're likely to call for the medical records, and they're going to send the form out for the HIPAA release. And when they won't sign the HIPAA release, which is the release for medical records, that's usually a red flag that there are no medical records anywhere to take care of this. Plus, they want to meet you in person. And so I've always found, like, when you actually visibly see someone, you have an opportunity to talk. And it's harder to, you have all the nonverbal cues as well as the verbal cues, and it's easier to find things. There's other things you can do too. Look for in their area, go to Target and see if they're registered for a baby shower. If they're registered for a baby shower, they're probably planning to parent that child as opposed to place that child, things like that. Yes. And those are the types of things that a lot of adoption professionals would know anyway.
Yeah.
But sometimes good scammer is a good scammer. And even with adoption professionals, sometimes they're going to slip through, and that just happens. I think that's one of the benefits of openness. The more that you get to know this person, the less likely you are to not realize it's a scam. I just wanted to circle back too, with addition to the connections through the websites that you pay a fee, one of the other things that is popping up now is there are Facebook groups for expectant moms to meet hopeful adoptive parents. And there is a new one for African-American expectant moms to find African-American families that has popped up on Facebook. There's a lot of other ones too. And if they're done correctly, the moderators will allow the expectant moms in and post for them, because there's always that real fear that the hopeful adoptive parents will pounce on any woman that comes in there and says, I'm thinking about placing. So the really well-moderated ones have made some good connections.
Okay. And we covered one pathway to adoption. You said there were three: foster care and the international adoption. Yeah. Can we go to foster care? Because foster care was the one that I considered the most deeply. I had conversations and I really looked at my life to see how that might, could I do it? And I got stuck at the home study because I've got a 2-bedroom apartment. My daughter is in one room. And from what my friend told me, I would have to position myself to do an intake quickly. And then I would have to have myself set up to have either a male child or a female child. And so I got stuck there.
Foster care is a complicated beast because it's different in every state, and sometimes it's different in every county. Mm-hmm. The first thing you have to figure out is, in your local area, can you do a straight adoption from foster care where biological parents' rights have been legally terminated? That's what most people who are looking to adopt want. There are people, obviously, who really want to foster. They have no intention of adopting. They want to help a child out and a family out during a period, and hopefully that child will be reunited with their family. Mm-hmm. But there are other people who are definitely looking for adoption. You have to figure out if your location will do an adoption that the parental rights are legally terminated. If not, you're doing what's called foster to adopt, which means that the biological parents' rights are not terminated, and that child could be reunited with their family at any point. And it's important to understand that the purpose of foster care is reunification with the family. The hope is that whatever was the reason that child was removed from the home, that can be fixed, right? And that child can safely be returned to that home. Also, the law provides that if the child can't go to the mom or the dad, that they're going to look at grandparents, aunts, uncles, anybody who's biological family first. So when you're fostering, that child may show up at your house, and then 2 weeks later, they figured out who the auntie is, and that child's going to go live with the auntie. So all those things have to be taken into account with foster care. That's an unusual circumstance where the social workers did a lousy job, to be honest, because you should be able to find family in a shorter period of time than 4 years. That being said, she's not the only one that's happened to. And I would say that at least 40% of the kids, if not higher, actually do reunite with their family. My guess is more 60 to 70%, to be honest. So that's a huge chance that the kid will be going back. Older kids are less likely because they're more likely to have the rights terminated. But that's the other thing. When you go into foster care, you can get a kid 0 to 18, basically, when you're going into foster care. If you're talking about domestic infant adoption, you're basically talking about a newborn. So one of the choices you have to make is, do I want a newborn? Do I want a 5-year-old? If you want a 5-year-old, you should be doing foster care or international, right? If you want a newborn, you might get a newborn through foster care, but there is no guarantee. In fact, a lot of foster care agencies will actually tell you they have no newborns. And the reason they tell you that is because they don't want you coming in and using them as an adoption agency, because they really are a foster care agency. That being said, there are newborns that come into foster care agencies, especially if you have a mother who's like on her third child that's going into the system. They're going to catch that child at the hospital, and that kid will go directly from the hospital to the foster family. And if there's no reunification, and she's already lost two kids to the system, so there's a good chance there won't be a reunification, you will get a newborn. But it takes a lot longer. When it comes to foster care, you're dealing with someone who has generally 18 months to do whatever she needs to do to fix the problem that had her children removed. Where when you're talking about domestic infant adoption, you're talking about a woman who contacted somebody to say, I'm thinking about adoption and I want to place my. There is a time gap usually between when the baby is born and when she signs the papers. But depending upon revocation, if there is or isn't, and a few other things, you're talking like 2 weeks at most, with the exception of maybe Pennsylvania. Where when you're talking about foster care, you may be in limbo for technically 18 months, but I know as a lawyer right now, I have a case where the kid's been in the home for 4 years, came as a newborn. Two more siblings have arrived.
Oh, man.
And we have not done the adoption yet, and it has to do with the agency. So some people, when they go through foster care, it's a long time. But here's the benefit, and here's the difference. Domestic infant adoption, there's a fee attached and it can be quite expensive. Foster care, no fee attached. They're going to give you a medical card. They're going to give you a subsidy after the adoption, which usually includes a medical card, a monthly payment like you are a foster parent, even though it's a subsidized adoption. And they may pay your legal fees too. It's a much more financially desirable spot for a lot of people to go through foster care. On the other hand, it takes longer. From my perspective, every adoption has some pros and some cons. And what may be a pro to one family may be a con to another family. And so every single hopeful adoptive parent who's going through this needs to assess what's really important to them and what works for their family.
Thank you, Michelle. Angela, how long was the wait for you? What was your experience?
Yeah, happy to. And that's almost always like in the top three questions that people ask, right? If I'm pursuing domestic infant adoption or international adoption, how long is it going to take before I become a mother? And the answer, quite frankly, is it depends. It depends on a lot of things. It depends upon which route you choose. As Michelle was just articulating, if you go the foster to adopt route, and again, the goal is reunification, you may never adopt to the foster system. And because of everything that the birth parents are going to go through, it could take years in court cases and it could take quite a while. So I know more personally, having researched international adoption, but also having gone through domestic infant adoptions. And also inherent within that question is not just how long does it take, but are the wait times any different for people of color, specifically MoCA SMC? So I can address both of those.
Yeah, that'd
so
be great.
I think I actually am fortunate to know about five or six other MoCA SMCs who have adopted, one who I knew in my church growing up who really inspired me to do it, and then several who are my contemporaries and our children are all friends and play together. One of them started the process with an agency and brought her son home, who was, I think, about a year old within 2 months. It was lightning fast.
Do you have time to get a crib vest?
Yeah, exactly. And that certainly happens, but I would say that it's not the norm. It's really hard to say exactly, but I would say on average, maybe, and Michelle probably has more stats on this, I would say between 6 months to 2 or 3 years, I think, is probably average wait. But when we say it depends upon which route you choose, it'll also depend upon your risk profile, if you will. And I make this analogous to if you go to a financial planner and they say, oh, are you young? Do you want to have an aggressive profile or whatever? When you pursue domestic infant adoption, they will ask you what risk factors you are comfortable with. So things like, does the birth mother, has she been drinking during her pregnancy? And was it during the first trimester or all three? Or does she smoke? Or what kind of other behaviors has she been involved in? Does she have a family history of physical or mental illness, et cetera, et cetera? So you have to, with an agency or with an attorney, consider all of these risk factors, gender, et cetera. So basically, the more open you are in that risk profile, the quicker you'll adopt, so the more boxes you check. If you say, oh, I only want a perfectly healthy girl from this state or whatever, then that's going to considerably narrow your options and most likely lengthen your wait. And then sometimes single hopeful adoptive parents of any race may wait longer. And what I mean by that is, you can imagine there are a lot of expectant mothers of color who are looking for families of color, whether it's a single adoptive parent or a couple or a family. And because there aren't as many of us available, because as Michelle talked about, adoption is often cost prohibitive, sometimes we'll get snatched up pretty quickly when we've been through the whole process and have an approved home study. So I actually matched only a few months after going live with my agency, ended up choosing not to go forward with the first two, but it was within 3 months. And then ultimately, the match that led to my son was a year and a few months later. And I think that's probably about average.
Okay. Michelle, you mentioned that there is a Facebook group. What's the name of that Facebook group?
Name of the Facebook group is Black Families Helping to Adopt, Expectant Mothers Seeking Black Families. Okay. And this Facebook group was created by a Black adoptive mom sometime last year in 2020. So that Black expectant moms could actually locate Black families. Okay. Because one of the things that has happened, I've been an adoption professional for long enough that I remember when Black families would get snatched up in about 2 weeks. If you waited longer than 6 months, that was extreme, right? These days, to say 2 years is probably about as long as I would expect anybody to wait that's Black. But part of that also depends on some other factors that Angela highlighted so well. Mm-hmm. But this, one of the things that has happened is because now transracial adoption has gone into the stratosphere, and that so many people are now willing to adopt Black babies that were not willing to adopt Black babies 20 years ago, is that it's gotten really, frankly, competitive. And there's a bunch of other things that have shifted over the last two decades, too. So when an agency actually gets Black families, well, I'm talking domestic infant right now, they hoard their Black families. Like, they, if agency A has a Black family, but agency B has the expectant mom, they often don't talk together. And
which is totally unfortunate.
Agency B never shows that Black expectant mom, Black families, even if that's what she wants. And so what's happening is that people have decided we're going to figure out a better way to do this so that Black women who are making this option can do this.
So I did want to pivot back to Angela on that, right? Because I think that there's this myth in the adoption community that Black families, Black singles, Black SMCs, Black people don't adopt Black children. Can you talk a little bit to that? Because as far as I've seen with my own eyes in my own communities and social circles, Black families, Black singles, we absolutely adopt Black children, want Black children. So this is a myth that I'm thinking is because of the money-making industry that is domestic infant adoption that gets perpetuated.
Yeah, I think that's fair, that it is a myth that's perpetuated. I think that most myths or rumors are originally based in some type of truth. And I think maybe years ago, families of color were more likely to have unofficial kinship adoptions, meaning we would just take people in and not necessarily go through the legal process to adopt those children, but to raise them officially. But I think that that marker that Michelle gave about maybe 20 years ago, I think a lot of things changed, and there are quite a few families of color who adopt as well. I personally know several other MOCA SMCs who have, and whether or not it's what Michelle was referring to because of the outright competition and the fact that adoption is a business, or whether it's because it's cost prohibitive, which I know we'll get to in terms of pursuing domestic infant adoption or combination thereof, I think it's a frustrating myth that perpetuates. And that's part of why we're having this conversation, to get people to realize that it is a true and viable option for MOCA SMCs.
I just want to add that why it's true that African Americans have always done kinship adoptions or taking in other people's kids, we've also always done formal adoptions. I like to refer to John Johnson, the publisher of Jet and Ebony. And his daughter is an adopted child, and she's now, I think, in her 60s. We've been doing this forever, but the thing is, we don't stand out. And so I think part of the reason this myth occurs is because when you have these commercials and everything else with white people with kids of color, it's very obvious that an adoption has occurred. But when Black people adopt kids, we're used to families that are all different skin colors. We don't necessarily always look alike. And so the adoption occurs and nobody knows that the adoption has occurred. So we hide under the radar. And there actually is statistics with foster care adoption, and we adopt more than white families. Black families adopt 17%. White families adopt 12%. And I don't remember the stats. I actually just saw them recently for domestic infant adoption too. Black families, we adopt a lot. But the other problem is that because of, I would argue, systematic racism, there's a lot of kids who also get placed and or taken away by Child Protective Services and are not returned to their families. Therefore, there are more kids in the system or more kids to be placed than we can actually adopt. And therefore, there are a lot of transracial adoptions. I would say that the average adoption in 2021, for most agencies, are going to run you somewhere between 30 and 40,000.
Holy cow, that is a lot.
Ow. So now that ranges. So I saw an adoption today that was 10,000, right? But they made the placement themselves. They made that match themselves, so they didn't pay an agency. There are some small agencies in the country that charge a little bit less. And there are agencies that are now up to about 50,000 too. Well, part of the reason is because 2 decades ago, an agency would give you a fee, and that was the fee. Everything was included. Now what's happening is you have these piecemeal situations. And so they give you a fee, but then the birth mother expenses are outside of the fee, right? Well, it depends. So some states have caps. Other states have, we have reasonable living expenses in a certain time frame. And then there are some states that, there are no caps, and whoever can pay the most is, and better place to make that match. So it really ranges. But the other thing that's changed is if you go back 2, 3, 4 decades ago, your birth mom was usually a 16-year-old who got pregnant and was still living in her mother's house, in her father's house. So she didn't really have any expenses. Your average birth mom today is probably going to be somewhere in her 20s. She's probably already parenting a child, maybe two children. And she is a grown woman with grown woman expenses. So we're talking rent. We're talking utilities. We're talking food in a way that we wouldn't be talking about the 16-year-old who was still in their mother's house. So that's a reason that part of the expenses have gone up. The other thing is people are crisscrossing the country to match. So every time someone matches outside of their state, they have to hire a professional in that other state. They're paying the birth mother expenses if there are any. Not every birth mother or expectant mother has expenses. But if she does, and you're paying her lawyer fees, you're paying the professionals to get all the health records, you're paying for her utilities, you'll end up paying a lot of money and she may not place. And then you're at another state 6 months later, not for the expenses. Now, you may get depending upon some lawyers will have a $5,000 retainer and they've only used $2,000. So you'll get some of that money back. So sometimes, or the agencies will continue to work for you because the home study is still useful for the next adoption. But her rent it's gone. You paid for it. You have to think of it as a gift. And that's why you really need to know what your budget is and not pay for something you cannot afford. If you can't afford it as a hopeful adoptive parent, it's not a good match for you.
Right. So thank you, Michelle. And so what was your experience like? Is there something that you want to add on that?
I would add a couple of things about finances. Everything Michelle said is exactly accurate. I would add that there are different ways to finance an adoption, and it is something you have to plan for, just like if you were planning to do IUI or IVF, right? You have to figure out what your path is and what your comfort level is. Your savings, which most of my adoption was financed from a sale of a piece of property. Sometimes people will borrow from family members, as here already mentioned. Sometimes they will have employer funding. Sometimes people will borrow from their retirement. Sometimes people will use credit cards. Sometimes people will do adoption grants. There are many of them out there. Sometimes they will do a GoFundMe account, church fundraisers, et cetera. But the one other point that I wanted to make was specifically, and the adoption tax credit, that's right, which is something that you can apply for after you adopt and get $14,000 back federally. But the last point I wanted to make about financing adoption is if you choose to work with an agency, one of the things that I recommend that folks do is to ask how their fees are structured. And Michelle's right, they are tied to specific events. And whether or not you have to pay the fees multiple times if you have a disrupted adoption, because most people will have a disrupted adoption, meaning you match and then it doesn't go through because you change your mind or the expected mother changes their mind. So one of the key things for me when I chose my agency was, okay, I have like my setup fees and I have my home study fees, and then there's an actual match fee. I only had to pay that once. With other agencies, if you match and the match falls through, then you'll have to pay another match fee. So that's another thing to ask about to make sure that you're not basically double dipping.
Yeah. So I think we're going to start to wrap, but I think this conversation could easily go on for another hour and a half. And we actually have a part two to the adoption episode where we'll go into a bit more detail. But before we start to close out, I did want to ask Angela and Michelle if you have any tips or pointers for MOCA agencies looking to scratch the surface about adoption at the beginning stages of thinking about it.
For me, I guess this would be my advice afterwards too, find your village. From the beginning stages, you need to find your village of hopeful adopted parents. There's tons of Facebook groups. There's obviously the MOCA moms. You want to find that community that understands what you're going through and looking for. And you're going to have to weed out some groups, mind you, on Facebook. But take that time and do it. I think it's also really helpful if you find people in real life. And then the next thing to do is to talk to an adoption professional. A lot of people spend a lot of time spinning the wheels And I'm like, come talk to me for an hour. I have a whole spiel I can give you for an hour, for 1 hour consultation fee, right? And it will narrow down all the things that you have to think about so that then you can come back to me. And if you're local, I'm going to say, hey, these are the two or three agencies I think you should go talk to, right? But people rarely, I usually see people on the back end, not on the front end. And I can narrow that focus quite quickly because I know the Chicago market, I know the Illinois market, and to a certain degree, I know outside of my state too, because people are crisscrossing. But I really think that people need to lean on their adoption professionals more. And please do not take legal advice on Facebook. The amount of people advice on Facebook is beyond, it's just mind-boggling. And there is so much just bad legal advice. The other thing is there's so much legal advice that just doesn't apply to you. So people conflate foster care and domestic infant adoption all the time, or how foster care works in California has nothing to do with how foster care works in Illinois. But I'll be an Illinois parent and I'll ask a question and I'll get the answers from California, North Carolina, and Texas, which is irrelevant to me. If you want to do foster care, find your state foster care adoption group on Facebook. And most states have one.
Thank you. And Angela?
My advice to a prospective SNC who wants to pursue adoption, I would say just don't be discouraged. The adoption community, as you've heard in this conversation, is complex and it's expensive. And a lot of people say that it's not for the faint of heart because of all the roller coaster, but people could say the same thing about pursuing IUI or IVF. And so I would say we are out here. There is a strong community. I 100% agree with Michelle, to build your tribe, to build your village. And don't be discouraged. If you go to a adoption seminar and you're the only MOCA person sitting there, it doesn't mean that there aren't more of us out there. Stick with it and keep searching and reach out and find folks like us, because we've been through it and we're all passionate about helping other people who are coming after us.
Thank you, Angela. Michelle, how can people reach you if they've got questions, just general questions, if they're in the Chicagoland area, how can they reach you?
Usually the easiest way to reach me is by phone, 312-857-7287. And you can email me to hugheslaw@mindspring.com, but I generally prefer a phone call because these types of things need a conversation to go with it. But either of those two ways. And until recently, if you Googled Michelle Adoption Attorney, I was the only one that popped up. You probably now have to put in Michelle Chicago Adoption Attorney, but I'll pop up. You can find me.
That's
I'm also
awesome.
A member of the Academy of Adoption and Assisted Reproductive Technology Attorneys. And so you can find me through their website too.
Okay. Right. Yes, thank you. If you like what you heard, please stay tuned for part two of the adoption episode. Well, Pod, thank you so much for taking the time to listen. If you like what you heard, please share this podcast with your girlfriends. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about the topics covered in this episode. So email me at mochasmc@gmail.com. And if you found value in the topics covered, consider making a donation using the link in the show notes below. Till next time, Pod. Bye now.